9142.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Michael Holroyd, the acclaimed British biographer of George Bernard Shaw, Lytton Strachey, and others, says the reason he wrote about other people's lives was to escape his own. He's now turned his eye on his own family, which boasts a lineage of fabulously peculiar people, a crew that rivals Nancy Mitford's Doughty family for all-round oddness. Michael Holroyd's parents met on a boat and sustained amicable relations just long enough to produce Michael. Then they fought about everything, including the date of his birth. To keep everybody happy, he preserved two birthdays 48 hours apart for each of them. He was raised by his paternal grandparents and by an aunt in a ramshackle, crumbling mansion. Mr. Putty, the name of the parrot, would echo back the shrill invectives that these warring relatives would hurl at each other. "You should be certified," the parrot would say, or "arrange for me to be shot at dawn." After years of being embarrassed by his relatives, Michael Holroyd began to feel drawn to them and to feel a need to trace his own origins. The result is a book titled Basil Street Blues, part memoir, part biography, part autobiography. Scratch the surface of any family Michael Holroyd has discovered and you'll find eccentric aunts, befuddled grandparents, weird cousins. Connection listeners, maybe there's no such thing as a normal family. What do you find when you scratch the surface of your own? 1-800-423-8255 makes the eccentric family connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Holroyd joins us in his studio from London. And welcome, Michael Holroyd.
Thank you very much.
How wacky were the Holroyds?
Well, of course, it seemed to me when I was young that this was perfectly normal to have an insulting parrot and to be brought up with strange grandparents and to have, as I did have, a Hungarian stepfather and a French stepmother and an Anglo-Irish father and so on and so forth. It seemed to be perfectly normal. I knew no different. It was only later that I discovered that this perhaps wasn't everybody's experience. In those days, it wasn't quite usual for parents to divorce and remarry so many times as mine did.
At what point did it become a burden or something, I mean, literally something to run away from?
I think in my teens when I became, like many young people, sort of self-conscious, to see my mother dancing on the tables with waiters and cracking jokes in six different languages, this was, I celebrate it now, you understand, but at the time I shrank away and longed to be invisible.
Do you mean it that that's what drove you to other people's biographies?
I think that I did feel that, compared so with my mother, my own, I'd speak no languages and I don't dance. So I felt that I was rather paralyzed, by watching, my parents and so on. And that I wanted to find out about how other people lived. And I went and, investigated. Mind you, what I did find out is, precisely what you said, that, all families under the polite surface are strange, have all sorts of secrets, and unlived lives in a way.
England, I mean, stereotypically embraces this kind of stuff. I mean, the wackiness. We Americans may be a lot more self-conscious about it and even more closeted. How did you come to terms with it? And what is the sort of the liberating process of realizing that people are strange?
Well, I think that if you think that strangeness is the mainstream of life, then you rejoin the mainstream of life and the history of the country and so on. It now seems to me that in their various eccentric ways, my family represented the sort of, not the downfall, but the decline of post-imperial Britain. My grandfather losing his fortune through a series of careful miscalculations. My mother travelling from country to country, landing up at one point at Acapulco in search of a glamorous home from home. My father alone at the end with only a dog to order about. These are all signs of a country, I think, in decline.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, do you associate eccentricity of that sort of British variety with decadence and decay, or with I mean, it has a vital side too.
Yes, it has. I mean, it's known that sort of geniuses are rather eccentric people. The only trouble was that my family didn't seem to have any genius, except in one thing. They had a genius for losing money. That they did do. In the great general strike of 1926, when my grandfather was 50, everybody gave lifts to other people because there was no public transport, no trains, no buses, no coaches. And he gave a lift at Hammersmith to a young lady in her late 20s, and didn't come home for 8 years. And that was the reason why it was said to me, I was told when I was young that I would inherit my fortune in the way of serious debts.
You know, I just want to throw this in. Obviously, this isn't original, but John Stuart Mill said the amount of eccentricity in a society has generally been proportional to the amount of genius, mental vigor, and moral courage it contains. I mean, do you want to make the case for it?
Yes, I mean, I think that if you had families or friends of total conformity and uniformity, you would lead a very dull, narrow, and unrewarding life. I celebrate what's called eccentricity quite a lot. Indeed, in my biographies, I've relied on it to become readable to some extent. Mm. It's simply that the eccentricities of any time reflect, in their various ways, the state in which the country is, that's all. We were in decline.
Well, I want you to give us a sort of a quick tour in your own sort of annals of eccentricity of the heroic figures, including maybe the lady in your grandfather's love nest, but, I mean, in George Bernard Shaw's family or in the Bloomsbury crowd or whatever.
Well, the Bloomsburys were said to live in squares and to have triangular relationships, which made them, at that time, very, well, in a way, very brave, I have to say, because they were working against Victorian values, which were very proper, very narrow. In 1861, the Prince Consort had died, and Queen Victoria went into mourning, and so did the rest of the country. And there were only available for people adventures overseas in empire building. So these people who broke up Victorian values were really very much to be celebrated. Shaw did it more economically, financially, if you like, on the basis of his breakup, to break up the British class system. And the Bloomsbury group did it in sexual morality, to break up who could marry who, really. And I celebrate that. My own family, as I say, was skilled at losing money. My great-grandfather had got a fortune. He was a general who served out in India, and during the Indian Mutiny, he had saved a lot of tea planters from being killed, being executed. And in gratitude for this, they gave him great interest in their tea plantations. And he ended his life at the turn of the century as what we'd now call a millionaire. And it was left to the next generation to dissipate that money. Alas, it never came to me.
Well, you get talent instead. Who are the heroic figures, though, in your sort of eccentric Hall of Fame?
Well, I think my father has come out as a new breed of hero, partly comic, partly tragic. He would not say no, as it were. His optimism sprang eternal. He was always creating brilliant new companies, which didn't... I wouldn't say they failed. They overshot success and landed somewhere else, put it like that. And he was a tremendously wonderful salesman, and he used to get masses of orders, but the people couldn't pay the money, so the company used to go in liquidation. But he was still working at the end of his life, setting up companies, and in a way he comes out as a sort of heroic figure, really, I think, a Don Quixote.
Interesting. I just want to say to the connection listeners in general, this is a game that any number can play. The premise is that no family, when you take a hard look, is anywhere near normal. Michael Holroyd, the biographer, has looked at his own. He says, you can see in the eccentricities of a family, something about the period they lived in. He associates the famous British eccentricity in the last 150 years with not only the breakup of Victorian values, but a tremendous talent for losing money. Look at your own family and share what you can at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. C.S. Godshalk is on the line. She's the author of a marvelous novel, Kalimantan, an American writer, too. Chris Godshalk, could you give us a short tour of literary eccentrics on this side of the pond or the other two, for that matter?
Well, good morning. I'm not sure I can give you a tour of eccentrics either on this side of the pond or the other without dragging in some of the dark side of eccentricity. Just listening to you both speak, I realize that we're really, I think, at a disadvantage in this country. We have all kinds of built-ins to avoid eccentricity. I think even those of us who love to read and consider ourselves open to new ideas, if we want to learn something, if we want to marry or give birth or divorce, if we finally have leisure for retirement, we immediately go and buy a book or take a how-to class. We have group meetings, and we go to experts. So in our enlightened way, we all look alike. And we seem to obliterate eccentricity and all the fruitful benefits that it can give. You will see it among youngsters. I remember about a month ago I was at a YMCA. I was watching some kids get dressed after swimming, and there was one little boy, I guess he was about six, and he put on his he put his leg in his underpants and then in his trousers and then in one sock, all done on one side, and then put on one shoe and tied it, and then did the other side. It stopped all the action.
You go, boy.
It stopped all the action in the gym. Everybody kind of looked at him, and the adult there said, "Why do you do it that way?" He said, "Because it's more interesting." And it kind of brought to mind all the wonderful small ways you can fire up your imagination and become more receptive just to daily life around you. Certainly, a lot of writers on the other side of the pond, as you say, had these small oddities in their life that kept them fresh. The one that comes to mind immediately is Colette, who never did anything the same way as her fellows. There was always some new way that Colette either fixed her hair or took a bath or made love, and it seemed to give her the freshness of a child, and certainly in her receptivity to what she was writing about.
Chris Godshalk, let me just ask you, I mean, what does eccentricity, that sort of thing, have to do with writing and writers in general?
Well, I think it's probably listening to your own drummer. If you're not doing that, you can probably produce a pretty good product, but it's not going to be yours. If you allow yourself, I really think what it is, and we haven't gotten to a definition of eccentricity, and that's almost like, well, it might be impossible, but I think if you allow a good portion of yourself to remain a small child, you're not scared or educated out of it. It shows in your work. You do have your view of things, and if you're lucky enough to be able to get it down on paper, you know it's yours.
Who are the writers besides Colette that make the point for you?
Well, one Englishman that certainly makes the point for me is Lewis Carroll. There you've got an absolute, what some people would call flaming eccentric, and yet I don't think we'd ever have the wonderful, he was one of those guys who will walk into a room and you'd have four people working on a problem for hours, and he'd take the box or the cube or the glass or whatever they were staring at and turn it upside down and say, "Hey, try this," and then walk out. This kind of person would write an Alice in Wonderland. And it's not just in literature. I mean, you had certainly you had a wealth of Victorian eccentrics that, I mean, that kind of climate, I think, almost nourished their creation because it was so negative to them. It was almost cartoonish. So you had great, great trajectories of imagination within the confines of the Victorian mindset. I don't think we have that now. We certainly don't seem to have it on our side of the ocean, at least to my mind.
Michael Holroyd, do you have it over there?
Well, what I think is that the culture of one country seems very eccentric to another country. The ordinary received opinions of one generation seem very mad to another generation, and so it goes as fashion and normality change. What I was worried about a little bit was that in parading my own family, now that they are all dead, was I exposing them to pity and to ridicule. What I really wanted to do was, in a sense, to create the music of the blues, the sadness, which is sung out long and loud until a sort of note of love breaks through. And I wanted to see if that could call the spirits from the deep. Because if my family could reappear between the covers of my book and actually somehow touch other people's lives in some way, engage them, then death itself would seem less final. And eccentricity is a great preservative of life, I think.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about eccentric families and family eccentricity with Michael Holroyd and C.S. Godshalk, the author of Kalimantan. Michael Holroyd's new book, a biography of his own family, so to speak, an autobiography, is Basel Street Blues. 1-800-423-TALK. Ray is calling from Iowa City, Iowa.
Good morning, Christopher.
Morning, Ray. Welcome.
I grew up sort of always thinking that my family was fairly weird. I grew up in a hippie family, lived in the hills of Santa Cruz in the 70s with a bunch of other hippies, and I remember wishing that we lived in this little house with a yard. I always wanted a house with grass on it, and it's just funny to me because then years later when I got married, I married this very traditional sort of normal Iowa family, married into this normal Iowa family, and come to find out that they're just as weird as my family was.
And, grass didn't cure them, you mean?
What's that?
Grass didn't, I mean, so to speak.
Grass didn't seem to cure their troubles, no. I mean, it's things like, in fact, grass was part of my story because one of the things I found out when I got married into this family was that one of the grandmothers, one of my wife's grandmothers, who lives south of Iowa City, every morning she gets up and if the weather's nice enough, if there's not ice or snow on the ground, she'll walk through the grass in her bare feet. And she claims that's what's kept her healthy for years and years and years. You know, and so it's things like that that to me are wonderful. And I think one of your guests made the point that I think part of what makes weirdness in a family is when you get some cross-cultural connections going on there. So you take someone out of what might be a normal circumstance and you put them in another circumstance, and they continue to do the things, they continue to keep the behaviors that they've done in their old circumstance in a new situation, and that kind of creates some interesting scenes there.
Ray, you're talking about sort of a hippie come to the heartland. Michael Holroyd, I mean, talk about the cross-fertilization of cultures, I mean, among your own parents.
Well, my mother was Swedish, and my father, as I say, Anglo-Irish. They did meet on the boat, and they got on terribly well, as you said, on water. things began to go wrong after the boat hit land. And things that now seem very endearing. My mother couldn't really pronounce J's properly. She would say, "We'll wave a Union Jack at the Jubilee." And this was very endearing to my father in the first few months. Well, exactly. But after a time, he grated on his nerves, this sort of thing. And so what seems very charming to begin with can, of course, go wrong. The sun, we all want the sun, but not in the desert, perhaps, so much. It's all relative, I think. But I like that story of Ray's, that sane and eccentric contribution from him about the bare feet. I think we all need to do things that make us feel better, and then we are better. And that is the sanity at the center of all eccentricity.
1-800-423-8255 makes the eccentricity connection with Michael Holroyd. 1-800-423-TALK. Allison is on the line.
Hello, it's Allison in Concord, and I'll take my answer off the air. I loved so much the author's remark that eccentricity, once it is understood and the people are gone, can be a great preserver of life. My family spends every family gathering talking about Aunt Molly, who was barking mad, and in today's culture would probably have been living in some quiet rest home somewhere. But I disagree with the author's reason for the acceptance of eccentricity in England. I believe it's accepted because it is practiced and tolerated in high style by the upper middle class and the aristocracy. Look at all the famous stories we have heard, very few of them, about high living and strange living. Very few of those stories are set in simple village life. I think those classes have an inherent superiority that says, I can do as I please. And I think that has much more to do with it than the breakup of the empire and the Victorian period of mourning. I have been to drinks parties not far from Basil Street, which alone tells me a great deal about the author's eccentric family.
What does it tell you?
It tells me that he's upper middle class. It's a very good neighborhood. I have been to drinks parties in London, not far from Basil Street, where an elderly man was one of the guests, and he had a silver ear trumpet, which he used, and other people had to use, and from his mouth came the most endearing, ghastly fascist remark. I think I'm finished. Thank you very much.
Finished in style. Allison, thank you. Michael Holroyd? I mean, would you say it's the upper middle class, but that was the seat of Victorian values, right?
That's true, and it was the people who rebelled against their own class who I think are the most interesting and brave. It's true to say that the aristocracy and the upper middle class are the classes with the maximum opportunity for downward mobility, an opportunity of which we exercised full advantage. I only went to Basil Street, really, when I came to research my book, so you can, and I live, I'm afraid, in a less grand neighborhood. But I think that nowadays the aristocracy are less well considered in Britain. This, what Alison was saying, is true of the past. It's not so true of the present, I think. Although, of course, my book is partly set in the past, but also makes its connections with the present.
Chris Gottschalk, I wanted to ask you before the break. The caller Allison says it takes a certain amount of money and class, perhaps, to be truly eccentric. Does it take a high level of brains, do you think? I mean, professorial eccentricity sort of high literary eccentricity?
I think brains certainly appear with an astonishing frequency when you're dealing with eccentrics. I certainly don't think you have to be upper class, and certainly in this country, to be eccentric. In fact, there are a lot of families that were similar to mine, where there were immigrant families trying desperately to fit in and to not be the ones who raised their heads and were noticed. And when you look back on family life on a day-to-day basis in this kind of a setup, you've got something that's totally wacky and truly eccentric, and it goes on for years because you've got language, for instance, that's used in strange ways. Children are not taught foreign languages, at least this is the way they're referred to, because the family wants the children to be totally American. So they're not taught languages other than English, but others are used in the house. So they're used as code. They're used when children are not meant to understand things. And of course, it only takes 6 to 8 months before the children start understanding them by osmosis, but don't let on that they're understanding them. And so you've got this wonderful morass of languages used on all different levels. And I tell you, if you turn into a writer, you draw on that all the time, because it's crazy and it's great, and you never quite survive it. One thing that always seemed to strike me is the eccentrics that you have in a family while you're living with them often scandalize and sometimes frighten you. And yet afterwards, most often when they're dead, you look back with great tenderness, and you realize that they were often the key glue to keeping things together over rough times.
Mm.
We redefine them in memory.
Michael Holroyd, does this sound familiar?
Yes, it certainly does. I can recognize that. Also, there's another point about what we call eccentricity. It dissipates anger. And anger is a great oversimplification of life. And we have to realize that all life is a tragicomedy. And behind much engaging eccentricity, as in the figure of Lewis Carroll that Chris mentioned, there is a poignancy and some sadness as well, perhaps tragedy.
It not only disengages anger, but it injects humor. I mean, you find yourself laughing at the most disastrous times, and it just pulls you along in such a beautiful fashion. I had one of my old maiden aunts always got lost. Was always taking the wrong plane, train, even taking a walk, she'd get lost. She liked motion, and we often found ourselves, we lived on Long Island, having to go out to the very tip of Long Island because she simply had run out of track, and she followed the dusk off and just enjoy her train. And we go and pick her up. And to this day, I mean, I took all kinds of voyages to the wrong places at the wrong times with her and got lost in all kinds of fashions. And it's one of my great joys in life. I mean, I'll take any form of transportation to the end of the line.
Listen, it's one of our great joys in life. C.S. Gottschalk, to have you on The Connection. I know we've got to let you go at the break. Thank you enormously for joining us. C.S. Gottschalk of Kalimantan. We're talking with the biographer, Michael Holroyd, about families, wacky families, your families, his family. Basil Street Blues is his book. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
We're a happy family. We're a happy family. We're a happy family. Me, Mom, and Daddy. We're a happy family. We're a happy family. We're a happy family. Me, Mom, and Daddy. Sitting here in Queens, eating with our things, wearing all the magazines, Golden Town Forest. We ain't got no friends.
We're talking about happy families who are also wacky. Our guest, Michael Holroyd, is a famous British biographer. He says he wrote about other people's families because he didn't want to look at his own until he wrote this new book, Basil Street Blues. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're all invited to admit it. There's a lot of weirdness in every family. Share what you can at 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Holroyd, I wonder if you'd just give us a taste of the plot, but your own prose in Basil Street Blues. Would you read a bit for us?
Yes, okay. I'll read a little bit from the 1950s when I was doing my national service. In those days, we all had to do 2 years in the army. And I'll read a minute or two from that. Before I joined my new regiment, I was granted 3 weeks' leave. It was the autumn of 1956. I went to Ingmar Bergman's somber film, The Seventh Seal, and during the Pathé News was surprised to see several of my colleagues gesticulating blindly from the screen. Their trapped expressions, like zoo animals, stared vacantly down at me while the commentator described the embarkation of the Royal Fusiliers to Egypt. National servicemen were being given the privilege of serving their sovereign by recapturing the Suez Canal from Colonel Nasser. There spread through me a sense that something was wrong. Surely I should have been up there on the screen instead of in the stalls. Next day I telephoned my adjutant, ostensibly on a small matter connected with dress. Cutting across a detailed query on buttons, he demanded to know where the hell I was. Did I realize I had missed the war? I was to put myself under close arrest and escort myself to the Tower of London. I arrived at the Tower of London later that morning, and standing to attention was cross-examined by two senior officers. Why, they asked, had I not responded to the urgent telegram summoning me to active service. I spent the night in Napoleon's room at the Tower. The following day, unexpectedly, came a reprieve. It appeared that the adjutant, in the heat of war, had addressed a telegram to himself. In the circumstances, there was little they could do except have me up on the minor charge of being improperly dressed. You are wearing the wrong buttons, Mr. Holroyd. Kindly take a week's orderly, officer. Not a glorious episode, I'm afraid, from my military career.
1-800-423-8255 joins the family eccentricity connection. Have you found the fun in your own dysfunctional family connection, listeners? 1-800-423-TALK. Juanita is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Juanita.
Hi. I was tempted and gave in to the temptation to call because I believe that Michael Holroyd and I share either a grandfather or a great-grandfather, and I can testify to the eccentricity of being extended to the relatives in the United States.
How can you, can we nail down the connection here?
Well, Corbett was my maiden name, and my grandfather was one of 13. He was the only boy of, with 12 sisters. There was Basil, there was Aunt Lizzie, Cyril, and, of course, as I told you, many more names. Now, I'm not sure exactly of the connection, and of course, my father, who's 85, knows all this, but he's in California, and I'm in Lincoln, Massachusetts, listening to this. My daughter's a professor at UMass, and she called me and said, Michael Holroyd's speaking. I think you must turn it on, Mother.
Is this, do you know these names, Michael?
Yes, it is absolutely true. So I have found a new relation. Whether she is sufficiently eccentric, we will have to discover as the program goes on, perhaps.
This could be volume two.
Indeed. I see that. I shall be in touch with my publisher shortly. but certainly my grandmother, and I was brought up by my grandparents, was Adeline Corbett, a Corbett from Cork, and therefore would have been the sister of that one brother of all the 13 children who went to the States. Yes, that is right. Yes.
And then there was another sister who was Lady Anderson, who came to the United States and settled in Ben Lomond and built a rather outrageous home referred to in California as the castle for many years. It has since burned and I believe been rebuilt, but nothing like the original that Lord and Lady Anderson built. And my grandfather, who was a Corbett, the one boy, met his wife, my grandmother, one of his many wives, I might say, visiting the Andersons in Ben Lomond.
Juanita, how eccentric was sweet Adeline Corbett in the legends that reached you?
Well, you know, I have not yet read Michael's book, and so I want to do that and see how much I can put together of the stories that have come down to me. Certainly, it was a family that seemed to go their own way, but with a respect to the culture of the day, I would say, just from what I've heard over here.
Maybe you should be calling your publisher. I just wonder also, is there an American way of dealing with these memories? I mean, did you cherish them, or did you rush to therapy?
Oh, yes, we do, and the stories go on and on. I have an 95-year-old auntie, Patricia, who was a Corbett, who has the best father go on and on with these stories, and we love them. And my brother is now doing some research on it and has gotten in touch with a cousin of all of ours who lives in Australia. And I think Michael also is in touch with her because she is... she's bringing us up to date on what went on over there. But now we have Michael's wonderful book, so it will be so easy to find out about everything.
Juanita, thank you. It sounds like a race to reach the Australian relative. And whoever wins will get the book contract. Michael?
I have been in touch with the Australians. Part of the Irish side of the family did go to Australia. Even my father turned up there desperately looking for create a new brilliant business once. But some of this is absolutely news to me, is particularly about Lady Anderson, who I thought was drowned on her way to the United States. So there we are. We learn more every time. Very interesting indeed. I look forward to hearing from Juanita.
Juanita, send him a note, 1-800-423-8255, the family eccentricity connection with Michael Holroyd. Phil is on the line.
Hey, Chris, another great show. I'm actually out on the street, so hopefully a car won't go by and make my voice.
It'd be too eccentric for words.
I'm in the middle of Cambridge. I've always observed that some of the more, in a lot of families, the children become eccentric despite the sort of desperate clinging to the veneer of normality of their parents, especially in the suburbs. And it seems that in recent years, what with various shootings and whatnot, that this has become perceived as almost a threat. And now we've got this arsenal of pharmacological weapons, you know, these drugs to sort of beat them back into normality. And I'm wondering what you guys think. Is it possible to stamp out eccentricity through these chemical and behavioral means?
Is there any eccentricity in Pharmacy Nation?
Right. Or is one thing if it's just a cultural rejection of eccentricity, that actually fuels one's eccentricity. But if they start drugging you, can you maintain it, you know?
It's an interesting question, but it seems to me it turns, Phil, on the question of whether the eccentrics themselves are enjoying it. I mean, if they're in miserable pain, that's one thing. Do your eccentrics enjoy the role, Michael?
Yes, on the whole, I think so, nor would they always recognize themselves as eccentrics. I think writers are in a particular position because they have a dual temperament very much. They involve themselves wholeheartedly in what's going on, but at the same time, a bit of them stands aside and comments, observes, sees what's happening, and that's the humorous side. I think eccentricity really is a way of keeping sane. I think that when people are made too aware of the fact that they can't be absolutely normal like their fathers, like the previous generation, and they have no outlet in eccentricity, then they go into aggression, then they go into anger and hostility. And that's where I think the great medicine against hostility and aggression is eccentricity.
But that's interesting. I mean, but do they medicate eccentricity in England? You've spoken of the sort of the balm of eccentricity, dissipating anger, for example, but as a kind of cure in itself.
I think that so long as eccentricity isn't in breach of the law, shall we say, and lands you in terrible difficulty, it is something to be recommended. I think we should have flexible, tolerant, humane standards which allow individuality. Other people's individuality is very often what we call eccentricity, which should allow individuality to flourish, because we all rely on the individual genius of each person to create a happy community. That's what I think.
1-800-423-8255 makes the eccentricity connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Holroyd, there came a point in your own thoroughly eccentric family where you were the sort of amanuensis for sides that didn't really speak to each other or want to. Can you explain that? How you became the author and the bomb yourself?
Yes, when my mother was planning to leave one of her husbands, she asked me to help her write a note to him saying why she was leaving and everything else. This is the first time anybody had really ever sort of said that I could wield a pen at all. So much gratified, I took out my pen and I wrote a note for my stepfather, who, after my mother had left for South America, rang me up that night and said, your mother, not my wife, your mother has left me this note, would you come over? So I went over and we had a few whiskies together, and he said, now look, you've always wanted to be a writer, and I beamed at him. He'd never really acknowledged that. Would you help me write to your mother? So I drafted a letter to my mother, and 3 weeks later, I heard from my mother in Acapulco saying, look, I've had this very strange letter from your stepfather. How on earth should I reply? Could you give me a hand? So I wrote a sort of reply, which she obviously sent to him. And over the next 18 months or 2 years, I conducted a most elaborate correspondence with myself, not quite realizing what I was doing, acting as advocate for both and in a way biographer for both. And towards the end, I did notice I was paying myself elaborate compliments, your excellent letter, and things like that.
That's absolutely wonderful. You kept copies?
No, alas, I never did at that stage, because I did the rough drafts and I handed it to them, and then, of course, they wrote in their own hand, and I never saw the, but I remember it distinctly. But it's interesting, now looking back and having that time concentrated, I realised what I was doing and the sort of hilarity and poignancy of what I was doing. But at the time, it seemed to me that I was trying to negotiate a perfectly reasonable settlement between them, anyone since I was, but using what I think people would call a most eccentric device.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, the hard question, how far did the apple fall from the tree here? How much of this eccentricity rubbed off on you?
Well, that's, of course, for other people to say. I think I'm a model.
You just tell us
absolute,
and we'll judge.
absolute normality. There's absolutely nothing wrong with me at all. I'm absolutely straight, as anyone will tell you. However, let me say this, that a lot of people do think that there's quite a lot of the child in me. And I remember earlier in our conversation, Chris saying that to let the child continue to live on in the adult sometimes produces what is called eccentricity. And I think perhaps I might be guilty of that.
You have a famous wife. How does she observe all this?
Well, of course, you'd have to ask her, but she does.
Put her on the line.
Alas, I wouldn't dare do that. I wouldn't dare. She did say, I remember sometime after we married, she thought I was she was marrying a scholar and a sort of biographer and so on, and hadn't realised that there was this other side to me. Whether that was a bonus or a minus, we really will have to ask her.
1-800-423-8255 makes the odd family connection. Dave is calling from his car phone.
Oh, hi. I just want to announce that Freeman J. Hawkins, the blues singer, he had 57 children, and they're looking for any of his possible kids. So if people are like have predilections for like jumping out of coffins and playing blues music and look like him, they should log on to www.jayskids.com, and then you can like submit, you know, because there's all kinds of
now, are you related, David?
Am I related?
Yeah.
I don't know, possibly. I'm like, if you really look like him, and you know, it's possible that I sent my hair in, so they're doing like a DNA test, so I'm like waiting to find out what happens.
Wow. Dave, thank you.
it shows you what blues leads to, doesn't it? I think my family one of the few not related to Hawkins, you know. Oh, dear. But I think my book has been a sort of Pandora's box, and it has released from other families, sometimes in Europe but also in the States, all sorts of half-forgotten memories of not just eccentricities, but dramas, irregularities, and a rich family history in other people's lives. And I had far more letters from this book, which I didn't know whether it would interest anybody, than from writing about famous people. And that's the interesting thing, because although in many ways my family is wildly different from many others, nevertheless there is some parallel, some reverberations in other people's families, however culturally different.
Well, you heard from Juanita on this program just now. I mean, is she typical? Does anybody object to these stories? Does anybody think frame them very differently?
Well, I think certainly Juanita is going to have some different memories. Her legends and my myths are going to meet in the middle of the pond, I think, somewhere. Because certainly some of the things she said I didn't know. And although the one son does appear in my book by name, he had to learn all the Christian names of his sisters, of his 12 sisters. You know, that was what he had to do. I think that, you know, facts get exaggerated and twisted over time, and I started off with one draft of my book, but then I had to go to birth, marriage and death certificates, street directories, census returns, and what I noticed on many of the marriage certificates is how men elevate their status, either in business or socially, where women lower their ages on these certificates.
1-800-423-8255 makes the family connection with Michael Holroyd, who's written the story of his own, called it Basel Street Blues. There's the blues connection, too. Bill is calling from a car phone.
Hello?
Hello, Bill.
Hi, I've got a humorous story. Wanting my family, well, knowing that my family is kind of eccentric, I recently got a new niece and nephew, and you're hoping that they're going to be normal. But my nephew, what he does is wear his superhero underwear. He wears them backwards so he can see the pictures of them when he's wearing them. It's really quite humorous. And now, you know, that's how he wears them all the time.
He wears it inside out so he can read it right way, too, in a mirror.
Not in, well, kind of backwards, what, you know, normally people would do, so.
That's a pardonable eccentricity, Bill.
Yep.
Indulge the lad.
We do, as much as possible.
Michael Holroyd, I wonder, you know, I know from the past that your parents haven't, your father didn't admire all of your work. What's the reaction right at home?
Well, surprised people, really. I have come through. I've made a life out of other people's lives, and nobody thought I could. And I've done it through really neglecting all the good advice I ever got. That was my secret. Whenever anybody advised me what to do, if I did the opposite, I was pretty safe. Though it took me some time to get enough confidence to do that. And I was interested in what Bill was saying about his niece and nephew, because he wanted them to be, and this is very understandable, normal. And it's very understandable if one generation wishes to protect the other generation, young people. But the real danger is if you overprotect them, and there's a great danger in this country at the moment, this is starting up for various reasons. Mm. If you overprotect them, you do them some more subtle damage if you don't look out.
What would your mother have thought of this book, do you think?
I think, though she is was Swedish, she would have laughed. The only thing that makes the Swedes laugh, really, is me trying to speak Swedish in their country. You should see them. It's as if they've been really out for quite a long party. But I think she would have liked it, because I wrote an autobiographical novel a long, long time ago when I was very young, which my father stopped me publishing in Britain. It was published in the States. And my mother thought it a hoot, and she really laughed. So I think she'd be all right. And I'd like to think that my father would come round to it. I would like to think that.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Perry is calling from a car phone.
Hello.
Hello, Perry.
I'm just wondering if Michael would think that my sister is actually quite a bit more eccentric than myself. My wife and myself.
We're settling a score here.
My wife and myself, we both look at each other and see lots of different things we do and say, you know, that you're quite odd or quite strange. Yet my sister tells me that her husband is as normal as anybody in this world. And I guess my opinion is that if you live with somebody, you see that everybody's strange some way or another.
Do you want to rule on this, Michael? It could be a marriage at stake.
I think it's a very good thing to acknowledge oddity. And if you have to say people are completely normal, either you are, frightened unnecessarily of what we've called eccentricity in this program, or haven't spotted the benefits of eccentricity. And I think that Perry's sister should look again.
People should look again at Basel Street Blues. Michael Holroyd, thank you enormously for joining us, and thank you for just sort of playing the game. Michael Holroyd.
Well, thank you.
Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it very much indeed.
Thank you. Michael Holroyd's book is called Basel Street Blues, a memoir. Thanks also to C.S. Godchalk, who joined us earlier in the hour. We had help today from John Hoder, John Marston, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. Our website is theconnection1word.org. Our website producer is Jim Norris. The Connection is produced by eccentrics named Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hathi, John Holtz, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our eccentric in chief. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by 10,000 villages where purchases assist artisans in 30 developing countries.